This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Richard Darman is not the most popular member of the Republican Party. Darman helped convince President Bush to break his Read My Lips pledge and raise taxes. At the time, Darman was the president's budget director. Now Darman has his doubts about the Dole tax plan. Darman has also served as President Reagan's deputy White House chief of staff and deputy secretary of the Treasury. Darman describes himself as a centrist, who often wondered how he ended up working with the more ideologically driven conservatives in the so-called Reagan Revolution. He's written a new memoir called Who's in Control? Polar Politics and the Sensible Center. He says that many members of the Reagan administration used ideology as a litmus test to separate the good guys from the bad guys, and Darman couldn't pass the test.
Curiously enough, part of the litmus test that was applied way back then was whether you had supported Ronald Reagan as early as 1964, and I failed that test. I also probably failed some of the elements of the ideological test itself. I was not for some of the constitutional amendments that defined the Reagan right at the time. I had not fully agreed with some of the Reagan policies in California with respect to welfare reform. So there are a number of issues on which I didn't pass the test. But I think the most serious offense in the minds of those who were applying the test was that I was associated with a moderate Republican, sometimes thought of as a liberal Republican, Elliot Richardson, with whom I was proud to have been associated, I should say. But nonetheless, in some people's minds, that was disqualifying.
In your memoir, Who's in Control, you write that the Reagan Revolution was more rhetoric than reality. How so?
I distinguish between the programmatic elements of the Reagan Revolution, balancing the budget. He didn't balance the budget. He said he would by 1983, and of course we know he had multi-hundred-billion-dollar deficits that carry forward right till today, and reduced the federal debt. It increased radically, passed constitutional amendments to ban abortion or allow school prayer. Those never moved forward through the system at all. So on down a long list of programmatic elements. He did get a major tax reduction, but he also increased taxes in 1982, 83, 84, 86, 87. People tend to forget that. So the programmatic elements of the Reagan Revolution were largely unfulfilled. I do think he succeeded in a different sense that might be considered revolutionary, and that's not programmatic so much as it is a matter of national spirit, national self-confidence, national pride. He restored all of those. People sometimes forget that in the 70s, America had an awful lot of self-doubt. There was talk of our being in decline as a society and as a country, of malaise. There was a sense that we couldn't accomplish anything, that presidents couldn't get anything done, that somehow the political system itself was fundamentally flawed. Within a very short period of time, President Reagan helped restore a national sense of confidence. I think that's his most important contribution, and I think it's a contribution that would justify an important place in history.
Well, let's look at the economics of the Reagan administration. You say, you know, that President Reagan really wanted to cut big government, and that, you know, quote, big government had been at 22.9% of gross domestic product at the start of the Reagan administration, and it was shrunk by 0.8% to 22.1% at the end of the Reagan administration. And you write, during the Reagan administration, the government grew to a scale larger than it had ever reached before. Federal spending reached 24.4% of the gross domestic product, a new and still unsurpassed peacetime high. Do you think the Reagan administration was responsible for creating more debt? Is the deficit that we have today, in part, the fault of the Reagan Revolution?
No, I think that there's fault to go in a lot of directions. Maybe we shouldn't call it fault. Let's just try to look at it analytically. Part of the problem came from the tax cut, the size of the tax cut. The tax cut was actually larger than President Reagan himself asked for, and that was because of a political process in the Congress that became a bidding war, including many Democrats in Congress bidding for popularity by gifts to the public in the form of greater and greater tax increases. Second part of the problem was that the Congress provided only half the spending reduction that President Reagan had asked for. And so the program was out of balance because he overachieved on the tax side, thanks to the Congress, and he underachieved on the spending side, thanks to the Congress. But you have to remember also, Paul Volcker was chairman of the Federal Reserve, and he was on a campaign that was ultimately successful and very important to radically shrink the hyperinflation of the 70s. He did so very, very fast. That exacerbated the problem of the recession, deepened it. In fact, the second deepest in the 20th century. The only deeper was the Depression. And that, of course, cut the revenue base enormously and increased spending for entitlement programs. So there's a number of contributors in this equation.
You helped convince President Reagan to raise taxes several times during his administration. In fact, you're right that you thought some of the tax cuts were a mistake all along, yet you helped push them through.
Well, I thought that the tax cuts would make sense if they could be balanced by equivalent spending reduction, offsetting spending reduction. And my assessment was that the political system was not likely to provide that amount of spending reduction. I think with the benefit of hindsight, people would agree. The political system for all these years since 1980, right to the present, has been unwilling to cut spending to anywhere near the degree that it pretends it's willing to do so. And as long as that's the political reality, deep tax cuts, which will not fully pay for themselves, are going to contribute to a deficit problem, that is, unless spending can be brought under control. So it was not because I don't think there are favorable effects from lower tax rates. I think there are. In fact, I worked for lower tax rates very hard in 1986 and successfully so. But I think it has to be managed in a way that keeps an eye on the need for fiscal balance at the same time. And the process was not balanced in 1981.
You were President Bush's budget director, and as everybody knows, President Bush, when he pledged no new taxes, read my lips, no new taxes, and you were one of the reasons why he ended up raising taxes. You really encouraged him to go through with that tax raise. How did you make your case to the president when he knew that he had so much on the line in not raising taxes?
Well, it was becoming increasingly obvious that the fiscal situation was not getting better. The economy was not strong. The Federal Reserve had kept money tight, and the economic growth that had been forecast was not as great as people had hoped or thought it would be. Almost every independent analyst and our own government analysts was forecasting much higher deficits than had previously been expected. And there was a provision of law at the time that required automatic spending reductions across the board if you were unable to achieve the deficit reduction targets by legislative action. That was known as a sequester provision, a word which hardly anybody pays any attention to. And most people, I suppose, don't even know of or care about. But at any rate, had that gone into effect, there would have been enormous cuts in, among other things, defense expenditures, and it was at a time when Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait, and there was a U.S. buildup underway for what ultimately proved to be the successful effort in Desert Storm. But in that context, the national security community, I dare say most of the public, would have been unwilling cut a giant swath through the Defense Department just as they were preparing to send men and women possibly off to their death in battle in the Middle East. And so there was a need to negotiate some form of compromise. The Democrats controlled both houses of Congress. We negotiated the very best deal we could get in that circumstance. The president didn't have the luxury of a Republican-controlled Congress, as has been recently the case. And all things considered, I think President Bush quite courageously went ahead and did what was known by him to be politically, potentially self-defeating. But he did what I think was the right thing for the country in the context. Would I have preferred a different and better deal? Of course. Would he? Absolutely. But was a better one negotiable in the circumstance? I personally doubt it. Indeed, I might say the bipartisan leadership of the Congress were all party to the negotiation, and with the exception of a single individual, every single one of them, Democrats and Republicans, felt that they'd negotiated a good and the best possible deal. It so happens that because it turned out to be quite unpopular, very few of them seem to remember that they were party to the negotiation.
When President Bush lost his reelection, did you feel partially responsible for that because you had pressed hard for the tax raise?
Well, I certainly have thought about it and worried about that a good deal, and I'm naturally defensive, I suppose, on the subject, and I've got an awful lot of arguments which can allow me to tell myself that I was not really responsible, and I think on the whole, I believe those arguments, but still it's a cause of some personal worry in my own part. I would feel very badly, and from time to time I do feel badly at possibly having contributed to the president's loss. I do think, however, most importantly, that he did and we did the right thing in the historical context.
Let's look at what the presidential candidates are saying now about taxes. Bob Dole pledges to finish the job Ronald Reagan started so brilliantly. That's a quote. And he is calling for a 15% across-the-board tax cut and 50% cut in capital gains tax, plus balancing the budget in 5 years. Do you think that can be done?
I think that the math, as presented by Senator Dole, works on paper. And I might say as an aside, President Clinton's math works on paper. I think in political practice, both programs, the Clinton program and the Dole program, assume more spending reduction than the political system has shown a willingness to give. So in that sense, neither one of them is being realistic. They both gloss over the question of what to do about the so-called entitlements programs, the big middle-class entitlement programs of Social Security and Medicare especially.
Now, what's your analysis of President Clinton's proposed tax breaks, tax credits?
Well, hesitant to say, but basically I can't think of an alternative to say they're political gimmicks by and large. I mean, take the one, for example, supposedly support tuition for junior colleges, 2 years, first 2 years of college all across the land. Is that really going to benefit individuals, or is that all going to go to expand two-year colleges who will raise their tuitions? Will it end up in people's pockets, as he pretends, or will it end up somewhere else? And if you said, given all the problems with the American education system, if we had all that money to spend, would we really want to go spend it for 2 years of junior college when we got a whole bunch of people who can't even pass fourth grade reading and a mathematics test? We have a very fundamental problem of primary and secondary education in America that itself demands a major reform effort. And I think the tax thing that President Clinton has proposed is sort of what Ross Perot called free candy before elections. It's a distraction.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Darman, and he's written a new political memoir called Who's in Control? Polar Politics and the Sensible Center. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Richard Darman, and he was President Reagan's Deputy White House Chief of Staff and Deputy Secretary of the Treasury. Under President Bush, he was Budget Director. He's not in politics right now. He's written a new memoir called Who's in Control? In your memoir, you describe yourself as a centrist who ended up in the Reagan administration, surrounded often by people who were much further to the right than you were. I'd like you to assess the Republican Party for us now from your point of view. Where is it politically in between the center and the right now, and what direction do you see it heading in, or what tug of war do you see happening now?
I think it's in the middle of an enormous tug of war, and the outcome is uncertain. I think the Reagan coalition, that where President Reagan came to power in 1980, was extraordinary and not to be carried forward. It rested on some peculiar historical circumstances. A large portion of the sentiment that led to President Reagan holding on to blue-collar Democrats and some white-collar populists who were not normally Republican was really anti-Carter, or it was a new sentiment concerned about changing American values and the erosion of American confidence and so on. There hasn't been a candidate, not likely to be a candidate, who can hold that kind of coalition together going forward. And so you've seen the old Reagan coalition coming apart and a struggle among its different factions for the right to lead the new coalition. So we have supply-siders, and we have social conservatives, and we have a very shriveled branch of traditional moderates within the Republican Party. And of course, as is often noted, the primary process tends often to include the kinds of people who are more strong, some would say extreme, in the views that they hold, and to discourage or exclude people who are somewhat more moderate. And I think moderates in the Republican Party have been left somewhat disenchanted and feeling that they're either not represented or they're, for one reason or another, best inclined to sit on the sidelines.
How do you feel as a moderate?
I'm at the moment just observing the phenomenon. I regret it. And I think there will be, but I can't prove or demonstrate, I think that there will be a substantial centrist revival. Of course, we're seeing it in the current election, but I don't take that too seriously. Both candidates are posturing for the center because the center is where you win or lose in American elections in reality, and they recognize that at the moment. But the question is, what's the governing majority, which is different from the issue of what do you do to win an election? How do you govern? To govern effectively, you need a strong and stable center and a coalition built from the middle outward, not from some extreme towards the center. I think Colin Powell, to a degree, represented the kind of person who could build such a new coalition from the center. There probably will be other figures between now and 4 years from now who will rise to prominence and visibility, trying to organize a new centrist coalition. Bill Clinton, of course, himself started out in before 1992 to run as a new Democrat, supposedly going to build such a new coalition. But then he, upon being elected, he turned way to the left and came up with this Clinton Magaziner health plan that alienated almost everybody, even within his own party, and failed to build that new coalition. It is still there to be built. The question is, who is going to build it? I don't think anyone has command of a natural governing coalition at the moment. The system is in flux.
As a self-described centrist, I'm wondering about your impressions now of Newt Gingrich's image. I mean, during a couple of years ago, all the Republican congressional candidates were trying to ride on his coattails, and now everybody's trying to distance themselves from him.
I think that there's an irony of sorts here in that Gingrich is fancies himself as, and to some degree he has been, a master strategist. But at the moment of his own rise to the greatest power and visibility, which I think was late 1994, when he'd been elected, re-elected, it was clear he was going to be speaker, and there was this enormous media attention. He had an opportunity at that point to think strategically about broadening his own base. And he's the kind of person who would think that way. And for some reason I don't understand, he decided not to do so, but to tie himself to the narrower base of the House of Representatives, the right flank within it, and the narrower agenda of the contract with America, or for America. And in the process, he took what might have been an historic opportunity to rise to even more power and create a new majority somewhat in line with his own thinking. He took his own popularity, or the popularity of those he was associated with, from near majority or majority down to 25-26% by having this much more narrow focus and base. It was a surprise to me that he missed that strategic opportunity, because he has fancied himself such a strategic thinker, and in fact has been a strategic thinker for most of his career.
So you see his position largely a function of strategy as opposed to deep belief and commitment?
Yes. You have to remember, he was originally a Rockefeller Republican. He doesn't advertise that, but he is a more complicated person in his thinking than simply a straight, by-the-book, simple conservative. There are areas in which he believes that government should importantly play a role. And at times in his career, he's reflected that. He's for government investing in technology and research and infrastructure. He gets infatuated, I would even say, as do I, with these things at times. He has found it convenient, certainly from the standpoint of preserving his power as Speaker, to put any trace of that aside and to stick to the narrow agenda. He would have been more successful, in my view, if he'd been willing to lose a little bit of support on his right flank and broaden his base and, I think, go with his more natural inclination towards a more creative middle. He didn't do it. I suspect he may have lost the opportunity forever, because certainly it's very difficult to recover from the low popularity that he's driven himself down to.
Richard Darman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Richard Darman's new memoir is called Who's in Control? Polar Politics and the Sensible Center. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.